Attention, crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking. This is a supplemental episode of Enterprising Individuals, where we bring you news and tidbits from the world of Trek, also interviews with special guests, and a few little surprises along the way. How are you? I hope you're gearing up for Hot Vax Summer. American Hot Vax, there we go. Get vaccinated, get back to whatever it is that you do best. I'm the best there is at what I do, and what I do is find increasingly esoteric subjects to cram Star Trek into. And I think I've got a doozy for you this week. I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, Ironweeds, which is hosted by three people from the city of Troy, New York, and it's ostensibly about local and state politics and issues germane to the Troy area. But in practice, it really ends up being an examination of culture, politics, and governance that applies to any community, large or small. And as I've been listening, I started to think about towns and cities and colonies and planets in Star Trek. Do you ever think about how we never actually see a colony or a community in Trek that is running well, that hasn't been taken over by an insane computer or hasn't been pacified by trippy spores? We barely ever see Earth at all or any kind of Federation community that is operating as intended. And it made me wonder, how do you do that? How do you run a Federation community, be it city, colony, or starship? How do you start a city in the Federation? Can Space Jebediah Springfield just plant a flag on the moon and declare a town? And who do you go to get Springfield's monument removed from the town square when it's revealed how problematic he was? Those are the questions that I brought to Dr. David A. Banks. The Star Trek ones, not the Simpsons stuff. David is one of the hosts of Ironweeds, and he's a former guest on this show. He's also an assistant professor of geography and planning at the University at Albany, SUNY. I wanted to see if he could help me get a better idea of how municipal government might operate in the future of Star Trek. Parks and Federation, if you will. I always enjoy talking with David, and I hope you enjoy our chat on this subject. If you like what you hear on the show today, I certainly recommend that you listen to Ironweeds. You can do that at ironweeds.podbean.com. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. I don't know who Al Gore is, and at this point, I'm too afraid to ask. And with that, let's get underway. Back on the show today is Dr. David A. Banks. David is a writer and researcher and is currently visiting assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Planning at University at Albany, SUNY. He's also the director of the Globalization Studies program there, and he's a delegate to the Troy Area Labor Council, which is dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and local level. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Aaron. Thanks for having me. You always do the most generous introductions.
I try to fit everything in there that I can. Well, I want to get your qualifications in there because of the thing that we're talking about today, but it's great to have you back on the show. We last spoke in early 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic was just ramping up, and now it's early 2021, and some people have gotten the vaccine, but we've got a long way to go as far as that goes with 50 states plus territories, federal agencies, and Palau, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands are on that list too, and it seems like a pretty daunting task.
Yeah, man. Wow. Has it really been that long already? Wow. Yeah. And yeah, it was a whole nother world a year ago. But I'm fully vaccinated because I teach in person, and there's some signs of optimism, I think, with some of the vaccine rollout, but unsurprisingly, unfortunately, right? It's uneven in a lot of places, in all the sadly predictable ways.
And applying, government services is always a struggle, but you're working at the federal level and then bringing it down to, 50 individual states, which have their own ways of getting these things out. And so, logistically, I think, we need to be patient. Obviously, it's important to get this to people. And I think over 40 million people have already received at least one dose of the vaccine. But, we're at about, like, I think 1.4, 1.5 million a day.
Yeah.
So, it's the hopeful future is that everybody gets it. I think I saw a projection that said at the current rate of inoculation, we should reach 90% vaccination by this time next year. So if people are looking for a definite light that isn't just a hallucination at the end of the tunnel, maybe that's what we should be looking for.
Yeah, I saw something similar. Yeah.
It'd be great to, to see other people again, to get back and do the kind of things that we're used to doing, you know, I go to a lot of conventions for nerd stuff, and I know that you do a lot of conventions in your work. And so having that just removed from our lives for 2 years has been kind of a weird feeling.
Yeah, it really has been.
Well, you've got a podcast called Iron Weeds, which I really enjoy. It's about politics and leftism and the very specific municipal issues of Troy, New York. Sometimes, but the issues that you talk about in the show generally apply to any city or conurbation.
Yeah. We try to, he's like, you know, so many places are a microcosm of everywhere else, you know, like we just kind of live in this like fractal society where, you know, the bizarre local politics of Troy end up sounding a lot like the bizarre local politics of wherever you live. So we do that beat, and it's largely you know, also like the Rust Belt kind of stuff, so like what it's like to live in post-industrial America. And it's been a lot of fun. It's cool to hear that that you listen. I appreciate that.
It's a weird, you know, it's a weird situation that we find ourselves in. And you mentioned, like, you know, post-industrialization and just the relationship of citizens to their government, something that's been thrown into stark relief with everything that's been going on, riots and protests, you know, in 2020, and people looking at and thinking about differently about how they're governed. And I think that, you know, we talk about how people just don't want to think about it, and they want to, you know, quote, get back to brunch, unquote. And I don't know if things are going to turn around. I think that people need to be more active, you know, in government, and they need to think about it more. But that just seems to be, that's part of success, right? That's part of prosperity is not thinking about that or just letting somebody else do that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's like this chicken and egg problem where it's like we need more, not only participation, but like effective means of like collecting that participation and doing something with it. Because otherwise, you know, people just get, you know, people tune it out. He's like, yeah, I'll participate. And then nothing happens again, you know? So but if you can't get the participation until you get effective institutions, and effective institutions don't quite form together until you get good participation. And so, yeah, it's hard to prime the pump on civil society. It's really hard. And you know, but we do see some green shoots, right? With like some local elections that seem really exciting. I'm working on a local election of a friend here in Troy, you know, like a young Black person that is like working really hard to become a city council member, you know? And like, it's really, you know, so I'd encourage anyone that, you know, wants to, you know, figure out where to start to like, see if there's someone promising or interesting running, you know, or run yourself. You know, there's a lot of barriers to making it, you know, make it like intimidating for outsiders, but it's not impossible.
I was thinking about the fact that there are, I think, so few examples of that kind of action, sort of the boring action of just, you know, doing day-to-day governance in our media. You know, when we watch our media, we're seeing, we can imitate, you know, the protesters that we see. We can imitate people, you know, acting out against the society, but there's so few. Like in Star Trek, for instance, we see none of the inner workings of this fabulous federation that has presented this utopia. We have no idea how it works at all. We know when it goes wrong. We know when somebody tries to, you know, do a military coup or something like that, and then they have to deal with what's going on there. But there isn't any real imitative sense of like, oh, just a drama about, you know, the steering the ship of state, you know, and what and how we can emulate that in our lives.
And I even in like the prequel sort of stuff with like the first couple seasons of Discovery and in Enterprise, which if you follow me on Twitter, you'll see every once in a while I'll be like, oops, I'm watching Enterprise again, don't know why. Those four seasons, that's something else. But anyway, but yeah, you know, in those prequels, you know, where you'd expect to find like the beginnings of a federation, right? Like and learning about like that sort of growing up into a interplanetary socialist seeming organization. Yeah, you get very, very few precious glimpses into what it means to live in that society. All that we really know we know a couple things, right? We know that, and we know it because we see it a couple times in A and B plots, right? There's there's Lower Decks where you can tell that, you know, like it's still your boss still sucks usually, you know. There's that. There's the Maquis, and then all of those episodes that are peppered throughout all the different franchises that or series where, you know, like there's the far-flung outpost that always has a problem with something, and so it's like obviously not like utopia everywhere, right? There's some grittiness, and then you get these moments with like Cisco's restaurant in New Orleans or the groundskeeper at Starfleet Academy, where you can tell that like clearly we could automate these things, right? We can make the EMH Mark I do it, you know, or we could make a robot do it or something, right? And we don't. You know, we have food replicators, so what the hell is a restaurant for, right? And so it's clear that there is something going on in this society where people choose to work, or what we would consider work today, and that the future, who is this? Is this a Gibson quote? You know, like the future is, even in the future, the future is unevenly distributed, you know? So, so it's clear that something interesting is going on, but we're never quite given the full picture.
Yeah. That's the real like myth, I think, is the uniformity of the utopia that we are promised in Star Trek. I believe that it's really great in a lot of areas, but I think we're led to believe through omission that it's, you know, the same everywhere. And that's probably not true. I've been doing a rewatch of Enterprise myself, and you're right about how it's part of its goal or its mission seems to be to show the uniting the establishment of the Federation. But very few details are given on that. And humanity just sort of like explores and kind of bounces around for three seasons. And then in the fourth season, they're kind of just in the right place at the right time, as there's a huge galactic upheaval between all these, you know, member races. Mm-hmm. And they're just the guy that's there to say like, yeah, well, maybe be nicer to everybody. And they're like, oh my God, thanks. Okay, let's sign this document right now.
Yeah, there's all the times where Archer's like, one day there will be a directive that will be prime in determining how we deal with species. And it's like, okay, dude, yeah, sure, right, you know, like we get it. It does seem like, yeah, it could be a missed opportunity. We could call it a missed opportunity, or it can be a little too accurate even, right? That sometimes really important historical moments are just being in the right place at the right time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. For no real good reason, like it turns out, oh, the Vulcan High Command was corrupt this entire time. And so they, you know, that goes away, and then they're weak as a political force. And so, yeah, why don't we all just sign this document?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's how we got Star Trek, so that's okay.
Yeah.
I heard on the latest episode of your podcast that you'd written a journal article entitled The Attention Economy of Authentic Cities, How Cities Behave Like Influencers. And I'm guessing you can't put scare quotes in the title of a journal article because the word authentic, the word authentic is doing a lot of work there.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about the pressures that communities are under that are unique to social media and the digital age?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll do one better, and I will link it to Star Trek. You know, is that basically the idea is, you know, ever since it started in the 60s that governments in rich nations start to, you know, federal governments, national governments start pulling away from direct help and influence in cities in municipal governance, right? So an example would be like, you know, in the Kennedy administration, they gave the federal government gave direct aid to cities to buy up the dying private mass transit companies and turn them into public enterprises, right? You see that in the documentary Who Framed Roger Rabbit, right? where you know the streetcar the streetcars are going away, right? You know, like that, it's sort of based on that. And we don't really get that anymore. Instead, we get in the Trump administration, it was called opportunity zones, but there was basically identical programs all the way back to Clinton. They're basically the same things, maybe even Reagan. And essentially the idea is that, you know, you give tax breaks in geographically defined regions to encourage economic development, but that's really it. And what that, and what I've been researching, and this will eventually become a book that I'm working on, is that, you know, cities across the world, but I'm looking at upstate New York, start acting a lot like reality TV stars and Instagram influencers, where they become like these hype beasts, where they try to, you know, take a few things about themselves. Usually it's something in their past, in the city's history, or it's some sort of competitive advantage about, like, you know, their location, something like that. And then they hype it up, and they post it on social media. They get it into all of these different magazines and media, travel magazines and stuff like that. And then you have stuff where, like, you know, your farmer's market has to have an Instagram profile, and now all of a sudden you have like public art that is meant to be the backdrop of an Instagram or a Snapchat or a TikTok piece of media. Yeah. Right. Sure. And so I'm just starting to study, like, just what are the implications of all that? And the tie-in to Star Trek is actually Sisko's restaurant, where, because with the authenticity part that I haven't really mentioned yet, right, is like, all these cities want to offer you something that, especially because, like, if you're not like a New York City or a Chicago or an LA, right, you have to offer them something else. And so what you can do is offer authenticity, because just like if New York City is like, you know, the Gucci brand, right, like something really high end, well known brand name, right, your Troy or some other small city can be like the really cool, funky thrift store find. You know, it's just that thing that you found that's like, wow, you're, you know, like, you don't follow trends, you you know, like, just, you know, think your own way and find stuff that's cool, not just what everyone else is doing. And right. And that's usually the tack that they go on. And with Sisko's restaurant, I keep coming back to this thought of, and, you know, this is where I guess what we're gonna, probably what we'll talk about for the rest of the hour, right, is like why, right, like, why would you have a restaurant when you have replicators? And it's of course has something to do with, like, it's not just the food, although it's like Star Trek canon that replicator food is what did the admiral in Discovery, the last season of Discovery, say? It's right. It's like,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. We just eat our own. Yeah,
it's made from us.
Yeah. Yeah. Because now there's cursing in Star Trek because we can do it's all streaming video. But, you know. So there's that, but it's also that, like, it's authentic, right? It's here's a long-standing tradition of going to a restaurant in the French Quarter and having jambalaya, right? And so it's that exact same move that cities do a lot of the time when, like, you go into a bar and it's like themed like a hardware store or something. It's like, why? You know, like, what's the point of, like, theming a bar over something has nothing to do with getting drunk, right? And it is largely, especially if it's something that is either like mundane or boring or even ugly, right? We do those things because it's a way to experience some sort of, like, past culture or you know, something frozen in amber.
I think people can really understand that now, having been inside for so long, and whereas, like, DoorDash is like kind of like our current replicator, where you just hit a button and the food comes to
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
But you miss sort of the experience of eating out. I'm just imagining, I just love the idea that the towns have to be savvy about. I'm imagining an anthropomorphized town on YouTube. Hey, what's up? It's your boy, Saratoga Springs. You know, like, it's just so strange that they have to work in the attention economy like that. But I suppose we all do.
Right. You know, hit like and subscribe for more tax provided content, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You say in the article that small to medium cities are competing to, you know, create this desire for, you know, identity performance, which is one of those terms that if you're a social media executive or a serial killer, maybe you just nod your head. But everybody else should feel a twist in their gut at terms like that, you know, impression management and corporate storytelling, context collapse. Social media is, it's the worst. But it's what we've got now.
Yeah. You know, I don't always immediately go to it's the worst, though I'm sympathetic to that argument, because it's like, right, because it's all these sorts of all these perverse incentives, right, where you have to be the most of yourself and never change, right? You have to like, now you've fit like a hash, you know, like TikTok has put you in some sort of algorithmic category, and if you don't behave in that category as expected, you lose all your followers and now right. And everything goes to shit, right? So it's like and it really does feel like our own cities are in a similar predicament, right? Because now they have to have the cutesy fun downtown with like an artisanal mayonnaise store or whatever, you know, you have to have all these things that clearly, which as we're seeing in this pandemic, right, don't weather economic downturns very well, right? Yeah, it's like if everyone doesn't have a lot of expendable income or time to safely go out and, you know, enjoy some sort of adult playground in their downtown, right? If they can't do that, then everything falls apart. Absolutely everything falls apart. And that's and that's what, you know, we're getting this like really hard lesson right now in that.
I think the most important question here is, what is the Bilbao effect?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. The Bilbao effect is, you know, it's a city in Spain, and that was kind of down on its luck, right? It's just, you know, Spain in general in the Southern Europe always has this problem of sustaining a welfare state on declining and aging populations, right? Uh-huh. And so what Bilbao did was, it was like, okay, we don't have really any industry. People are leaving. We don't really, like, there's no competitive advantage here. There's like, you have to come to us for some things, but we could hire a very well-known architect and have him build like a world-renowned performing arts center in this like beautiful, in a beautiful building. And then like all of a sudden people just have to come to us to admire the building and go see a performance or something. Sure. And they did it, and it just happened to work, where now it's like it's a whole city kind of built around this star architect's edifice, right? This performing arts center. So so when urban planners and people like us start talking about the Bilbao effect, we're talking about like, you know, what's the one thing that you could maybe build or entice to show up to your neighborhood that will then, like, you can just build your entire economy off of it. And it's, you know,
it's like a sports stadium, probably. Right,
yeah, well, you know, it is closely tied to stuff like, you know, getting the Olympics to come to your city or something like that, which frequently the Olympics committees actually have a really hard time getting cities to host them because they're starting to realize what a bad deal it is.
Yeah,
you know, because you just end up with like all of this hastily built infrastructure. It's like, really, how many swimming pools does a city need, right?
Right,
you know? And you're like, what do we do with this afterwards? Yeah. so like, you know, like after the Beijing Olympics, like it was a slide I show my students a lot. Is like, you know, this massive complex. It's like I think they did the gymnastics in or something, right? This enormous thing surrounded by an enormous parking lot, and now the stadium is completely empty and they just use the parking lot for driving tests. Like that's what it's used for now. Yeah. And that stuff happens all the time with leftover Olympics stuff.
That's bad news. Talking about food, or going back to food and not being able to eat it in a restaurant, I think that we've reached like a certain level of dystopia with the introduction of ghost kitchens. I saw an article a few months back about the phenomenon of ghost kitchens, that is like a restaurant that has no physical location, but instead operates by agreement out of another facility, in the way that your Uber driver isn't a cab driver. He's not an employee of Uber. He takes you in his car where you want to go. Ghost kitchens are the food delivery versions of that. They've got targeted offerings like grilled cheese sandwiches, you know, or burgers. The YouTuber Mr. Beast has launched Beast Burger, which serves up burgers and fries. And, you know, there are no physical locations. I think they're made out of bukkas or something like that.
Yeah, Buca de Pepe's. Yeah, in fact, the one by us, I think might have Beastburger, but it also definitely has. And I was, my wife and I were getting kind of excited about this last night. In fact, was Guy Fieri's Flavor Town.
Oh, okay, yeah,
is also operating out of there. So I don't know, like what millennial mid-level marketer at Buca de Pepe's is like swimming in cash right now that really came up with the idea of like, let's just rent out our restaurants to kitchens to all these ghost kitchen things. But yeah, like YouTube star Mr. Beast operates Ghost Kitchen is like, it's just like 2 years ago, that would be the like nonsense, right? That would be Mr. a total word salad.
Ghost Kitchen, yeah. I mean, it seems like the kind of entrepreneurship that the internet was made to facilitate. Like,
here's your chance
to open a restaurant without the buy-in of having a building and all those employees. But just from a practical standpoint, having something made and delivered by a concentric assembly of contractors means the responsibility of delivering something desirable or even edible gets smaller and smaller. Like in the same way that your DoorDash guy feels no remorse just throwing the bag at your front stoop as he drives by, that now extends to like the people making the food as well.
Oh yeah, at 100%.
All the reviews I see about these places are just terrible.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's all awful. It's just like, it was cold and like, I didn't even order this and like, someone wrote a mean note to me. No, I don't think so. No, mostly I feel bad for like all the people that have to work that job, right? Like I'm here comfortable in a warm house, and tomorrow I'll go lecture to my students, right? It's like I have a much nicer time than anyone that works in any of those jobs. It sucks for everyone, right? The only person, the only person who feels like this is an improvement, I think, is like the one person at the top that owns all of it.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Beast is doing fine.
Yeah.
Is the gig economy just like a transitional form to drones and robots, do you think?
Oh, whoa. All right. that's a good question.
At least in terms of delivery, I suppose.
Sure. Yeah. So there's a couple things. Like, one, I am of the opinion that like self-driving cars will never really happen the way that they're said to happen, right? Where like, you know, we'll just replace driving your car with this like hailed thing that shows up.
Westworld.
And this really is an answer to your question, trust me, is that like it's telling that, you know, like self-driving, you know, you look at the headlines in like Wired magazine or something, and it's like self-driving cars 2 years away, says analyst. And it says that like for 10 years, it's been 2 years away. Right. And I think often we mistake a technical problem, right? Like teaching a car with a series of sensors to drive, right? We confuse that with a much more diverse problem of not only technology, but also law and social dynamics and urban planning and weather, you know, a bunch of stuff like that.
Where
I think what the actual invention that will allow autonomous vehicles to have any sort of high adoption rate, which would include maybe, you know, like the automating of getting your Taco Bell, you know, without human interaction, right? Yeah. Would be if we not only made the cars drive themselves, but they also have to have like dedicated roadways that are locked off from everything else. And you'd also have to have this legal regime that made it, you know, like your fault if you get hit by an autonomous car. Which is what we did at the beginning for the regular cars, right? Is like we had to, you know, the GM and all these car companies lobbied very hard to make it your fault if you get hit by their vehicles, right? So it's right, so it, we'll just do that again. And it's like all this stuff that you have to build up to figure out how to make a world that is compatible with the autonomous vehicle, not necessarily the other way around.
Right. I wonder about, you know, you see in Star Trek all the time, as a function of just doing something cool in the episode, but like they run into an alien race that doesn't have like transporters or replicators, but they have a very specific technology. Like they can communicate 70 years of a man's life to you in a couple seconds, but they can't get off their planet. Okay. And I wonder like what, you know, if we don't become the Federation or people on Star Trek, like what humanity's like superpower, what we have to add technologically to the universe is. And right now it seems like it's like the predictive algorithm, like the process of data mining and using that to something. And when the Vulcans show up, like the only thing that we'll have to offer is we can tell them what Hogwarts house they're in, and that's pretty much all we can do.
No, yeah, I imagine them showing up and it's like, Captain, how do they know that I want a burger right now? You know, just like everyone, just all of a sudden, like these pop-up ads show up in front of everyone. They're like, why do they know my deepest desires? And yeah, it's right. Just like horrifying, and they just end up getting like really scared and leave. You know,
yeah, we're not going back to this planet. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, from that vision of our world being seduced by ease, let's seamlessly transition into the world of the 24th century where. Does anybody have a job? I don't know. I know that Cisco makes jambalaya, and that's all I know. I'd contacted you a while back about this idea that I had, and it was an idea that was prompted partly by listening to Ironweeds and hearing about you and your co-host's involvement in local politics, specifically Chris running for city council in Troy. And I got to thinking about Star Trek and how we never really see civilian life in the franchise. You know, we're only following the military, Starfleet. And if we see the government, it's a really brief flash, and it just kind of looks like representative democracy, you know, business as usual. But nobody ever votes, and you don't hear about senators or city councils or anything like that. And I thought that we should look into that. And the best way to do that would be to, I think, imagine what it would take to create a city or a community in the Federation and what issues that they would have to deal with and who would be doing the dealing. Sort of like parks and Federation, but with a lot less Joe Biden. To do that, the first thing I did was Google how to start a town. And I immediately realized that this was a terrible idea and would be infinitely complex. You know, it goes beyond simple urban planning. It involves outlining a government, distributing your resources, and infinitely more things. Like all cities of the capital region, will our town have to convince people that this is a cool place to live?
Yeah, right. So eventually, if you Google hard enough about how to start a town, you'll eventually get to a guy named Ebenezer Howard. He's a. Did you come across that name at all?
No.
No. Okay. So Ebenezer Howard. Yeah, he's a weird guy. He's a. He grew up in Victorian London. And tried to strike it rich as like a gentleman farmer in Nebraska. He moved to Nebraska and like the frontier to try to make it as a farmer, failed completely, moved back to London, became like a legal aid guy. And this wasn't very fulfilling for him. So he would join these book clubs that usually study these novels at the time that were very popular called utopian romance novels, and it's probably some of the worst fiction imaginable. It's really yeah. bad. It's yeah. It, yeah. you know, it's these things where it's like, and the book that really inspired him was Looking Backwards, I think it was called, and it's a book about a guy that like wakes up in the year 2000, right? Yeah.
A lot of that
and. All of these wonderful, and it, basically the whole book is people walking him around and they're like, let's go to the clothing shop, and he goes to the clothing shop and it's just like one outfit in the building, and he's like, how does this work? And then it's just like five pages of like how the whole clothing shop works and stuff, right? Which actually it does sound a lot like Amazon Prime, right? Where it's like there's no inventory, it gets shipped instantly. You get it's all based on what you want, not necessarily what is in inventory at the time, stuff like that. So it's kind of prophetic in that way, but it's also very egalitarian. And so what Ebenezer Howard was thinking of was like, well, let's just do it, right? Like, how do we do it? And he writes a book called a peaceful path to real reform. Oh, it's it, tomorrow, colon, a peaceful path to real reform. And it's a very, it's a really thin book. It doesn't sell very well until he starts trying to like build his own town and convince like local titans of industry to like fund it, and so he gets a little bit of help with the marketing, and they reissue the book as Garden Cities of Tomorrow, and that time it actually catches on really, really strong, because it instead of saying it's a social project, they say basically it's a design problem and an economics problem. So here's all the ways that you can like start a brand new town and do it peacefully, right? Is there still this tinge of social politics to it, where it's like, because it, really the alternative, right, the peaceful alternative, what it is an alternative to is violent Marxist revolution, right? And so he's like, if you don't want that, what you want instead is you empower a bunch of, you know, rabble, you know, the working class, to go buy a piece of land out on the outskirts of the city. And then you would phase in like farmland, and then from the products of the farm, you build a railroad track that brings it to market. And then with the proceeds from that, you build the first things. And I won't go into it because it's a bunch of like, 19th century, like political economy kind of stuff. But it's a really, it's still a pretty boring book, but it basically lays the foundation for all modern city planning. Starts with that book, because you had never really before then thought of cities as interchangeable like things to look at. You just before you'd be like, oh, like I know a lot about London, like that, and that has nothing to do with Cleveland. They're not transportable information. So if we're thinking 24th century, right, like, you would first want to just start with like, well, what's the prevailing like land tenure system? And by tenure, how do you relate to the land? Do you own it? Do you borrow it from someone for a long time? Right, stuff like that. Yeah. And then like, what keeps everyone fed and sheltered? Is the next step. And if you have a bunch of replicators and stuff, and you have some way to get free energy, then those answers become very, very easy, right?
Yeah, we did a show about utopian fiction a couple seasons ago, and it just discovered that like these are all basically just like socio-political treatises with a little bit of time travel at the beginning, just to get you into it.
Yeah, very, like very thinly veiled. Yeah,
they like can't the get published, so they're just going to take advantage of it being, of the novel format to go like, here are my ideas, put them in your brain.
Yeah, yeah. It was sort of like just jumping onto the fad of the novel.
Yeah. Well, so I was thinking to like answer some of those questions, I was thinking for the sake of simplicity, and maybe it's cheating a little bit, but this is Star Trek, and it's not only not real, but it also conforms to a center-left late 20th century political ideology. We can make a few assumptions. And that's like, first, I think we have essentially unlimited resources thanks to Federation technology. I think something like building a space elevator or a cyber ziggurat is probably out of the question. But like building materials, energy, and workforce aren't really considerations. Like we can have a bunch of little Robert Picardos digging a hole if we need to.
Photons number two, free.
Yeah, well, there you go. Number two, the government is, it's what we all want to imagine that the Federation is, fully automated, gay, luxury space communism. But everything we see on screen points to representative democracy with like an emphasis on collectivism, I guess. Number three, people have jobs, but they don't have to have jobs. Mainly, they don't have to work themselves to death. They can do kind of what they want. And number four, I'm guessing cars are not really much of a thing. Mm-hmm. And other than that, if there's anything you want to add to that, we can do that. But
no, I think that sounds like pretty much, the basic building blocks. I think like in almost every episode where there is a small colony or village that you visit, there's always a botanist for some reason. Mm-hmm. So add botanist in there too.
And as far as land, that's a great question, because the question of ownership of really anything in Star Trek, but definitely resources, means of production, and land is an open question. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that people own land in the future of Star Trek?
Yeah, that's really hard. You know, I mean, there's references to territory and claims to planets, right? Because of course they always like kind of always work at the level of planet, right? It's never
right. Like, it's all monoculture.
Yeah. And like the Cardassians can't own like a whole, like a continent, right? They have to have the whole planet.
Or half a planet.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so it seems like there's at least property, which is kind of different from owning something, right? It's like, with property, it can be like, well, I use this thing regularly. It's not that I just sort of like own it and gain rents from it just by virtue of having some sort of legally defined relationship to it that like I can call a number and the police will show up and shoot you if you try to take
presumably
it.
Presumably that it doesn't exist.
You're right. Yeah. Like that sort of thing doesn't exist. Right. So you'd imagine that it's largely, some sort of, you get to a point where these sorts of questions just kind of don't matter. Right. It's just and if there is any dispute over like where you put your dilithium mine or something, that's arbitrated in some way. And with the representative democracy thing, I mean, like on the one hand, you could argue like that's boring to depict on television, but on the other hand, you know, it's like, gosh, you know, like how many people like just can't stop watching the West Wing over and over again?
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Right. You know, and you know, and how many times have you seen, you know, like the hot take on Twitter where it's like, what if we just did the West Wing, but it's in space, right? You know, it's like, there's, you know, people ask for that all the time. And I can't say whether or not that would be a good or bad thing to watch. You know, I'd probably be pretty good to have a lot of intrigue and stuff, but, you know, and generally, you know, it could be possible that, you know, often technology supplants legal authorities, right? Like the two are interchangeable more than we generally think, right? So, because, you know, if technology enables you to do something, then all of a sudden you need to write down agreements about whether or not who can do that thing and what and under what circumstances and stuff like that, right? You know, we know that with like self-driving cars, right? Where, you know, there's all these legal trolley problem sorts of philosophy issues of like, you know, like, well, should the autonomous car kill an old person or a baby? You know, like stupid stuff like that. That was actually something in MIT technology review, I think, was something like that. It was like, what would be better? It's like, oh, okay, cool. This is the best we can do is decide does the Tesla kill a baby or an old person? Great. Right. So, but that does, it does point to like, a kind of problem that you will always have with these, with like creating a village or a town in a Star Trek like universe, is you will have to decide, like, you know, if the shuttlecraft crashes, you know, who's at fault, you know, stuff like that. Or if, you know, you assume that, you know, like some civilization like the Federation, you know, like established the colony, you know, what are the conditions under which, like, you know, like that initial giving of energy, land, people, whatever, like, does that get paid back at all? Like, is there, because at the end of the day, especially as we've seen with this last season of Discovery, right? Access to resources does to a large degree determine how high-minded the Federation can be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we do see that underneath like this, you know, representative democracy, egalitarianism is like, you know, the dilithium must flow. You know, that's crucial.
Sure. Right. And also they sidestep the question of governance when the Admiral guy just says, I've been authorized by the Federation president, which you haven't seen on screen, to debate with this other representative of their government and make all the decisions.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that, for the other shoe to drop on that. Like in the fourth season where we find out that like they're all like locked in a basement or something.
Yeah,
like, they just happen to show up in the middle of a military coup. Like the Discovery happened to show up in the middle of a coup. And he's like, no, this is all cool. This is exactly how things are supposed to happen, guys.
Right. You guys didn't do this? Yeah. I was thinking about where that town would be and why we're suddenly just creating a new community that's not related to something specific. And the answer would probably be that it's a colony. It's on another planet. But that might interfere with our rule of access to ample resources. And I started thinking about, remember when Picard was recovering from being assimilated and he goes and he stays on his family's vineyard?
I watched that one recently. Yeah.
An old friend of his invites him to join the New Atlantis Project.
Yes.
Dubious idea where they're going to raise a part of the Atlantic seafloor. Well, let's say that, you know, by the time of Star Trek Picard, this has already happened and it's ready for inhabitants. So we've got terraformed virgin territory. It's like the Palm Islands in Dubai.
Right.
Only hopefully not constructed by slave labor. Although we don't know what the Federation does with its prisoners or with its Robert Picardos.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's EMH Mark Ones. They're the slaves
they're building the ziggurats.
Oh, the Federation, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, so who gets to live on New Atlantis, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. And how are they distributed as a population? You know, I thought a lot about size because, you know, we're not limited by resources. But, you know, eventually people get on top of each other no matter how many hoverboards they have. And I looked at the average size of a city in America. There are 16,410 cities with a population of 10,000 people or smaller out of around 19,500 cities total in the U.S., according to a 2019 survey. So the average American far and away lives in a quote-unquote small town.
Mm-hmm.
So let's shoot for around 10,000.
Yeah. Yeah. So how would that start? Well, first you would have to, the thing is most cities that exist today exist for a specific reason, right? Mm-hmm. Where I live in Troy, it exists because we sit at the confluence of the Mohawk and Hudson rivers. And it's basically the furthest north you can go up the Hudson in a seafaring ship before you start hitting waterfalls and stuff. And that's why the Erie Canal started here and goes out to the Great Lakes, right? And so you have to have a point where you take the cargo off the seafaring ship and put it on something that can go up and down the canal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's very labor intensive, and you also need a bank and insurance companies for all that sort of stuff, right? So that's why Troy exists, right? And that's usually the case for most cities, unless you're Salt Lake City and you just get
right.
Some religious weirdo just decides to
right here.
Yeah. It's God told me to do it here, which actually started up here in upstate New York, and he went all the way to Salt Lake City. But So for the New Atlantis project, it would have to be something we need a new center for botany, right? You know, sort of new new center or employment facility, where new science and philosophy and whatnot happens, right? We could also imagine, retirement communities, someplace quiet. If everything else is loud, and we've met all human needs in an egalitarian fashion, right? You would start building places based on recreation, desire, New Horizon.
Sure.
The quarter of the continent's devoted to Burning Man. I don't know. You can kind of do whatever you want. But I think it's usually specialization related somehow to the geography of the region. Something that it's naturally suited to in some way.
Once you're ready to make those decisions, I'd have to wonder how zoning would work in this economy, or that is to say, the lack of an economy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can just say Main Street here, houses there, resource management facilities here, but commercial interests in this case don't drive anything if nobody needs to make any money or run a shop or sell anything.
Yeah. So, So the first zoning, modern day zoning that we would recognize comes out of a Supreme Court decision. A disagreement in Ohio, the proceedings called Euclid, the city of Euclid versus Ambler. I think it's a realty company. And it's basically deciding whether or not municipal governments have the authority to say what happens where, zoning. And that's basically been how, you know, we manage and regulate land in most countries now, because we've exported that model to most of the world. And, you know, that's kind of how that, how a lot of that works. But what's interesting is in the way that the Soviet Union would build new towns is they had a very, it actually wasn't that much different, because it's all based on the idea of, like, you don't want to live next to a factory, right? No one does.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and different uses for land can be synergistic and be nice, right? Like living next to a park is cool, or your retail being next to the place where the things are made can also be advantageous, right? You know, and sure. Then there are disadvantages, right? Like living next to a stinky factory or living above a loud bar. You know, like you're not going to put right. like a retirement home above a nightclub, right? You know, stuff like that. So. So usually most of that's never really changing, unless you if we think of the Federation, where like everything just goes boom, you know, like just pretty much all productive activity makes a vroom sound, you know. Maybe that's not so much of a big deal, you know. Like I don't know how loud a shuttlecraft is like in person, right? So maybe that wouldn't be so difficult, and you can have different uses really, really close to each other. Like I know that the only different one of the biggest difference really of Soviet urban planning, how they planned in the Soviet Union, is that instead of in the American context, the densest part of the city was usually devoted to commerce, right? Your financial district, your really tall gleaming towers of commercial activity that are usually empty, outside of 9 to 5, right? Those centers would usually be devoted to civic infrastructure. So that's where your city hall was, or your Soviet commissar's office or something like that. Sure. Or just like a 10-story Lenin statue, you know, like those sorts of things. But,
right.
Yeah. That's what was in the center of cities, usually surrounded by some sort of green belt, and then whatever else happened away from that. So it is usually pretty much the same everywhere.
How, I guess I'd have to wonder then, how regulated is the Federation? I'd imagine very regulated. I mean, they've got unlimited stuff. But you'd have to have like almost unlimited rules about how it's handed out.
Yeah, I can't imagine the Federation being very libertarian about much of anything, right? So there's definitely going to be a lot of rules about like where stuff should go and when you can use it. And then you have to imagine, right, if you're like Cisco's restaurant, where you don't absolutely need to make food. And so therefore the whole purpose, the reason for existing of something like Cisco's restaurant is for the preservation of culture and heritage, then you have to start managing culture and heritage as a government. And that can get real sticky real fast, right? Because like, does the government recognize your culture, right? And like, will it then allocate precious land for you to cook your food or have your church or something like that, right? Like these are that gets real hairy, is like when the government can decide whether or not you're worthy of like heritage status or something like that.
And the little glimpse that I'm just going to assume that he's on Bourbon Street. The little glimpse that we get of Bourbon Street is like very standard Bourbon Street now, which is, you know, Bourbon Street of the 20s. Uh-huh. So over the course of 400 years, how many people have families who have historically made Southern New Orleans food and all want a berth on Bourbon Street? Like, why does Cisco get to have that restaurant instead of anybody else?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, that's a really good point. Maybe this is like a new Atlantis thing, right? Is I mean, you know, like I live in New York, right? And New Orleans, you could do the Futurama joke, right? Like New York, you know what I'm saying? Like you can say like, well, obviously this isn't New Orleans on like new New Orleans on New Atlantis, right? But you can say like, well, this is a new kind of French Quarter. This is this postmodern mix of Bayou and Miami, kind of Caribbean something or other, you know, and just okay. put that in, you know, just put that. I mean, like, why not, right? You know, it's
sure,
it's,
yeah.
It's really the only thing that can still have scarcity, right? Is a heritage attachment to land is not something you can replicate. So if you can still terraform a new continent or whatever, right, in the Pacific, but
sure.
then you have to convince a sufficient number of people that you can do the same heritage as you did in the Louisiana Bayou or something, right? And sure. like and that's hard, and you'd have to figure out. I don't even know what sorts of civil society, cultural heritage, government issue organizations would even be capable of that, because right now we live in a pretty cynical time where, you know, like, people don't agree or like trust the government very well. So you can imagine a situation where people trust the government better, or it's better at providing that. You would say, oh, okay, cool, the government's going to open up new land so that more people can have like a Bourbon Street restaurant, but it's New Orleans, and you just like walk into a transporter and you just like Bourbon Street never ends, and it just goes directly into this new Orleans on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, that would be crazy. I'd like to believe that like the utopian future means that everybody is ready for their turn at the plow when it comes, or whatever it takes to keep the system going. But realistically, some people are going to want to be left alone. I imagine that there'd be like a certain class of like recluse types in the Federation.
Sure.
Like diet libertarians who get their hands on a replicator and they're like, you know, the Federation Council is not going to tell me what to do. And they live in the woods, you know, with their maker. We see something like that with Rafi in Star Trek Picard, where for personal reasons, she's just living alone in the desert, like on her own.
Yeah. Yeah. She's just vaping out in an RV in the desert. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool. Like, I appreciate the vapor representation in Picard. Yeah. It's, I mean, like, that would no doubt happen, that you'd have people who, even born at the heart of this Federation, like, want nothing to do with a highly communitarian society. Of course that would happen. And that could be the reason for the existence of new colonies on completely different planets. It can be a fight over existing land, existing places. Yeah, like, all of these, like, there's also no telling, like, I don't remember any time where they say how many people live on planet Earth. It's probably more than there are now, but maybe a lot of it's very compact. But it could also, there's also, you know, in the same way that cities, you know, like, there was a flight from cities in the last quarter of the 20th century. Like, there's no reason to believe that, like, you know, people wouldn't just get up and leave planet Earth and go, you know, live on Mars or something, right? Yeah, and now you have a bunch of open land where you can, you know, be left alone, do your Ted Kaczynski thing in a Montana cabin or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's hard for just your regular rank and file audience to wrap their heads around the idea of a human diaspora. You know, you could have Earthlings living anywhere really in the galaxy. And the only time that we really see him is like when it's, like you said before, a colony that's in trouble, you know, there's spores or something like that. And the Enterprise has to visit it, but yeah, you could definitely just Earth 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, wherever.
All right.
Yeah. Most towns, or at least a lot of urban infrastructure is built around, you know, public thoroughfares, arterial roads and things like that. Without roads, if we don't need them at all, because we've got hovering shuttles, that would definitely change, I think, what we think of as your typical city structure.
Yeah, this is the thing that really messes me up as you know, someone who teaches a course called Urban Design in Public Space is like not even a shuttlecraft, right? But a transporter. Like, do you design around transporters? Yeah. You know, I think it might have been the first time I was ever on your show. I said that transporters are a social media, right? Is it's just like they let you go almost anywhere instantaneously, and
yeah. It's like Logan's Run.
Yeah, yeah, and so you can just like be, instead of like mediating your relationship through a screen or a hologram, you can just actually be there, right?
Right.
And so like
physical Tinder, yeah.
Yeah.
You're so just literally like, there, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, like, so you have like Nog going to Starfleet Academy and then going to New Orleans every day for lunch, right? You know, like you can do that. You sure. just transport over. So like the, so the, which also then brings up like, yeah, like you can live one place and then work somewhere else on a completely different planet or on the same planet, which does kind of make sense as to why, like we were kind of joking about earlier, why like, you know, like you never see arguments about like even continents. You know, it's always planet is sort of the atomic unit of like territory in Star mm-hmm. Trek. And that's yep. probably why, right? Is yeah. And this is how, like I was saying earlier, how like technology and legality like are often interchangeable, is like territorial disputes will of course be connected to the range, the effective range of transporters, of yeah. transportation technology.
Yeah.
Right. Just as today, like regional disputes are fought over like the range of missiles, right? And like mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you have a nuclear device as long as like you can't get it onto a rocket, right? You know, like that's the big scary part, is like how you can launch the thing, right? So right. so that's of course going to be in there, is like yeah, as transporters definitely, and just like transportation in general, like really messes with my head in the Star Trek universe and how you would design a city, because yeah, there's no really good way of telling how you would design around that. And we do know that a lot of car infrastructure from the past gets preserved, but isn't used for transportation infrastructure, because right. in, was it Discovery, I think? There's a shot of the Golden Gate Bridge, and the bridge is not a roadway. It's all solar panels.
Yeah.
I don't remember where I saw that, but I think it was in one of the new Treks. And you know, like, so that tells you right there that we're not designing with roads in mind. It's all flying and atoms transporting all over the place. So like, I have no, but we're still in some way connected through heritage or whatever of like stuff like the Golden Gate Bridge, even though, you know, theoretically we don't even need it anymore.
Yeah. Just not having to like plan and build parking alone, it's like a total game changer. Although to be fair, with all the gentrification that's going on in my area, they're not worrying about parking. There's no parking to be had for all these people that are supposed to move into these condos. Yeah. It's like, it seems like in this kind of economy or in this kind of world, like the actual physical location, you know, like land is like the only real scarce resource. And it makes me wonder why we don't see more habitats on Star Trek. We don't see more space stations, you know, or I don't know, ring worlds or something like that. You think with the Federation, with its resources, could just start making planets and just making environments to solve the problem of the scarcity of land or location.
Yeah, and it's also like, with the exception of like Mayweather, right? Who's yeah. like, who's like a what do they call him? Like a space boomer.
Boomers. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Like that was like the only time where you really talk about like what it means to like be a generation of people that like aren't connected to a planet. Right, that right. like live life.
And then meanwhile, there's a preschool on the Enterprise D, so that's yeah. just that's obviated completely. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, clearly, like it just becomes like no big deal that you live most of your life on a starship, because the starships get more comfortable and it's more likely that it will happen. But there's never really like, but like if you think about it, like how many things would change about how you live if you was always on starships, right? Like the concept of a day or a year, right? All your time sort of stuff is messed up. The
sure.
Idea of like nationality is obviously not going to be a thing. You're just like a member of the Federation, but it's like, you know, what happens if that ship gets decommissioned? That's like not just your home disappearing. Like that's like your entire neighborhood. I don't know. It's just like, it's wild that you would like just never be able to come back to like the place that you grew up in completely. Right. You know, like, yeah. obviously that happens to some people and it's really sad, but like, I feel like there's something a lot like even bigger happening with that on the ship. Yeah,
you would have to form and let go of bonds, I think, very fluidly, and maybe, you know, that sort of the people that you do want to associate yourself with, you know, be in a collective or a group with, would shift to whatever version of communication or social media they have, where, you know, you are keeping in touch with somebody. But yeah, the people around you would change week to week or month to month, just depending on assignment. You know, if you're patrolling the briar patch in the Enterprise, you know, 1 week, and then you get reassigned to like a deep space mission, yeah, it's just a completely, totally different neighborhood, like you said.
Yeah.
There's a lot of logistical problems that can probably be solved with technobabble or something. Let's move on to the idea of governance and what the government of a Federation town would look like. And I think in this case, you know, I was thinking about the things that you need to start a town, which is generally, it depends, you know, from place to place, but a signed petition, a proposed form of government. And a lot of times you need a charter that's granted by the state legislature. But in this case, that wouldn't exist. Like, are there states in future America?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good question. There's, right. But I think you're right that the basic ingredients in, you know, like any sort of conceivable society would be some sort of organization, yeah, and a document, right? Like that, you know, we just get as broad as possible, right? A document that outlines the organization mostly and says like where this social, legal entity, political entity exists, right, in time and space. Sure. And and then as we get more specific, yeah, we can think through a couple things, right? There are massive changes in the United States, what's called during the Progressive Era, which a lot of people probably like had a half a chapter on in high school American yeah, history, right? Where, but like what is usually glossed is the idea that, you know, like a lot of local government was radically changed in that time, where you would essentially replace elected political figures that would like run on with a party to like these very weak nonpartisan, like you didn't need to affiliate with a party, like councils that weren't empowered to do a lot. They would basically hire and fire a professional that would run it as a city manager or executive of some kind. Yeah. And this was and the idea of professionalizing this kind of job is, you know, has some obvious upsides and downsides, right? Like the upside is that like you don't get like, you know, a Donald Trump figure, you know, or like just like someone, sure, who's completely unqualified for the job that just like hoodwinks enough people to get into office and then just makes themselves rich or and their friends, right? Yeah. You know, so like you would ostensibly miss that, and you would you would benefit from like someone that like, you know, like went to school and was taught how to do all of these things, and you can professionalize this program. And of course the downside is that obviously that's not very democratic, right? And
yeah,
and if what's taught in the schools to become a county or city or whatever executive or manager, right, if what's taught in those schools is against your interests, whether for, you know, religious or political or whatever, ethnic, what, you know, like really whatever sort of thing you can come up with, right, if something about that is against your interests, then like you're screwed all over the place, right? Because there's nowhere yeah, to redress your grievances. And so like that's sort of the balance that we have to get here. It seems like the Federation is kind of leans into that though, right? It's like less democracy, more.
They seem pretty cool with singular leaders.
Yeah, yeah, a little less democracy, more professional scientific management, which is generally okay because that big problem of like, what if you are antagonistic in some way to what's taught in the professional thing, right? There, everyone is so well off that it doesn't really, like the consequences are probably not much more than like, you know, color schemes on buildings or something, you know. It's like, right. like there's not a whole lot that, like, you're not like thrown into a concentration camp or something. Yeah. I there's probably an episode that proves me wrong on that, right? But somewhere, but you know, like, yeah. So you would have that situation, and then we do see that, you know, like, with increased technology, especially communication technology, we can effectively govern more space with less people, right? In the same way that you can do all sorts of productive work with less labor, right?
Yeah.
With technology. So it is possible that, you know, like, fewer places have local government because either everything is, you know, you think of what your local city deals with, and it's like, well, do you need taxes? Well, not really. If you don't have money anymore,
right?
Although the Soviet Union, you still paid rent, but it was just sort of like a means of balancing resources more than anything else. You know, so sure. Yeah, okay, you don't need it for taxes. What else do? They, you know, like, they run the city pool, or you just think of all the things that local government does, and most of the time it's things that could be obviated in some way by massive change, not just like a new app, right? Like, I'm not, definitely not saying that, you know, like, you can get rid of your city government today just by having a really good app, right? but well. it does seem likely that, you know, like, the real changes to technology in the 24th century may not require as much city government, right? Because if you can transport from, like, Dubuque to
Sao Paulo,
what kind of jurisdiction are we even dealing with here?
You need somebody to cut the ribbon for the new library or something like that.
That is true. Yeah. Well, you just get a Dabo girl to do it. It'd be way better.
Sure. Yeah, hey, that would work. I think it's crazy that, like, you know, there's that episode that we see where they go to Earth and there's the military's trying to do a coup, and we see the president. And I think it's kind of nuts that there's a Federation president still. I mean, I know that it's supposed to be something familiar to the home audience, but when you think about how many worlds there are, and why is there this one guy with executive power? But I don't know if that's an effect of just the way that, like, all these things in Star Trek, you know, we have to try to, like, figure out these weird explanations for them, when it's really just, you know, Star Trek exists because of JFK or whatever. And so therefore, obviously it's a great man theory of history, future.
Right.
But, like, I wonder in their world, like, just people like Zefram Cochrane, you know, who created the warp drive, which is credited with, like, pulling them out of the detritus of World War III, like, if they just keep this idea of, oh no, we definitely need, like, this singular leader. There's no way that just a representative town meeting could solve all these problems. And in that case, I think there would definitely have to be, like, a mayor position. Although it might just, his duties might be limited to cutting the ribbon, like I mentioned.
Yeah. You would also have to think, like, I just popped into my head is, like, because I was thinking, like, well, yeah, like, there's probably, like, some sort of humans generally kind of like figureheads and appreciate just, like, the ability to attach emotional energy to, like, something specific. But, like, do Andorians do that, right? Or Vulcans, right? So right. Which leads me to think, like, I wonder if maybe there are elections and we just don't see them. And, like, those elections not only pick a person, but they pick a whole, like, plug and play system of government at the top, right? Where, like, because maybe, like, you know, Andorians who are, like, always, like, backstabby and don't trust anyone, like, maybe, like, they, you know, like, when humans are in charge, it's a president, and then when the Andorians show up, it's a triumvirate. And then, like, the Vulcans have, like, a committee of scientists or whatever, and, like, just, you know, whatever wins doesn't install a person, it installs an entire system,
and it turns over every 4 years.
Yeah, sure.
That sounds completely unmanageable.
Yeah, right. It does.
But I love that idea. Yeah. Oh no, the binars won, so it's just going to be like a bank of servers who's going to run us for 4 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's that computer that, you know, what was it, a in Lower Decks is a sign on it says "Do not obey," right? do not worship the. They just like take the sign off. Like, I guess we're, I don't know, the computer won. There's nothing we can do. It's, you know, we did a recount and everything.
We probably should try to wrap it up here. I've got one more comment or one more thing that I want to talk about, and it's probably in a whole nother show. But how do you keep the peace in this city?
Ooh,
if we don't have property, we don't theoretically need police. I guess we could get robot dogs like you have in New York now.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, right.
We don't ever really see law enforcement in Star Trek all that much. I think there's some guys that pull McCoy out of the bar in Star Trek 3 when he's making trouble. And then Jim Kirk, as a boy, of course, in the 2009 film, drives his dad's car off the cliff. And then we see a swoop bike cop or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah. And then there's, and you do get the sense that like any sort of security in public life is seen as very, very creepy and dangerous. When Sisko comes back to Earth they're under guard, and like, there's like security forces all over the place because they're expecting the Dominion to show up or something. I think it is, right? And everyone's like, oh my God, I can't believe, there's a guy with a phaser at the end of my block. It's horrifying, you know? And it's So we definitely get a sense that at least at the heart of the Federation where, you know, like Earth is a utopia, but, you know, like maybe SETI Alpha 5 isn't, right? You know, those are, it does seem like the need for any sort of reconciliation has got to be something that doesn't involve someone walking around with a weapon, which sounds great. I think it would have the easy answer that I'll give for the sake of time is that hopefully most of the time disagreements are so petty because people have so much that, like, you know, you just have like a small claims court that you go to for everything or something like that. And if any of people get, you know, and you can repair bodies so much better that if there's like a physical altercation, you know, maybe you go to the penal colony in New Zealand that Tom Paris went to for a little while, and then the other person's healed, no harm, no foul. Maybe you got to, you know, go to some classes or something.
Some restorative justice. Got to bake him a nice cake.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining me for today. This is a fascinating topic. I know it's not exactly what most fans come to the franchise for, but I'm always down for making the future of Star Trek feel more real.
This was so much fun. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, remind people where they can find you and Ironweeds online.
Absolutely. So I have a whole dang website, davidabanks.org, where you find my writing and all the different projects I do, including this is the most visited page on my site is the social themes in Star Trek, where I've listed it is actually looked at a lot. I need to update it. So, you know, don't at me about that. I absolutely need to organize it better. And then, you know, on Twitter, it's DA_Banks, BANKS. And Ironweeds is at Ironweeds Pod. That's Instagram and Twitter for that. Find me on there. And thank you, Aaron, so much. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks again.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, we forgot to name the town.
Oh, darn.
It's like old Star Trek would be, it's Galileo Town or something
that.
And then new Star Trek would be, get some representation in there, but don't really worry about the context. So it'd be like Indira Gandhi Town or something like that.
Man, that is spot on. Yeah, no, yeah, old Trek would be like Abraham Lincoln, you know, right? Yeah, and then new one is like Grimesville or something. You know?
Backtracking is back for an all-new season. Hi, I'm Caliban.
And I'm Gooey Fame.
And we'd like to introduce you to Backtracking, the podcast that explores the real-world inspirations behind your favorite episodes of Star Trek.
From historical events to classical literature to blockbuster films, we go where no pod has gone before to seek out the origins of classic Trek tales.
Did you know, Gooey, that the TNG episode Too Short a Season was an allegory for the Iran-Contra affair?
Yeah, only sweatier. Did you know that the Enterprise episode Regeneration was an homage to the John Carpenter film The Thing?
Archer and T'Pol freezing to death over a bottle of whiskey would have been a controversial ending.
As a dog lover, Archer would not like The Thing, I'm guessing.
Oh my god, movie night is canceled. Join us every other Thursday for a journey back to the beginnings of the Trek universe.
Backtracking is available wherever you get your podcasts.
No, Porthos!